ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Michael Shine. Michael is the founder and president of the marketing agency Microfame Media and the author of The Hype Handbook, 12 Indispensable Success Secrets from the World's Greatest Propagandists, Self-Promoters, Cult Leaders, Mischief Makers, and Boundary Breakers. It's a forthcoming publication from McGraw-Hill, which will be released on January 12th. We'll be delving into how hype works and how anyone can harness its power. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
First, congratulations on your book. I met you while you were still thinking about the content and working out some of the ideas. And one of the things I remember us discussing, and it really stuck with me, is if hype can only be bad, if the word has pejorative overtones, or if it's just that when people who we like deploy it well, we consider it marketing, and when people we don't, we call it hype. And can you explain exactly what hype is?
Yeah, so it's funny. I just ran across a quote the other day.
Conveniently.
I'm always researching this stuff, right? But so I'm always reading this kind of material. But there's this guy named Jay Hendricks, and he wrote a book called Thank You for Arguing, which was one of my more, recent, revisits. And he talks about the Greek roots of the word hype, which is short for hyperbole, and it meant to throw forward. So all the way back then, it was a neutral term. It meant to put stuff out there, right?
Right.
So the reason I chose the word hype instead of marketing is because it was kind of a wink and a nod, right? I took back what most people think of as a negative word, to hype something up. But I consider myself a student of hype and extol the virtues of hype, because when people think of marketing, they think of the tactics. Are we using Instagram? Are we using advertising? Are we using sales funnels? All of this stuff. But really, the idea of generating a large emotional reaction from a large number of people to get them to do what you want them to do, hopefully positive, but it doesn't have to be negative. It's just that thing, generating a lot of emotion to get people to move in a certain direction, or at least that's how I define it.
Yeah, well, I have to say right out of the gate, even the concept of using that word in the book itself is using one of your first rules of successful hype, which is bucking the trend, picking a fight, which is something that you did early on, a bit of an aha experience. And I'm talking about your Vaynerchuk column. And can you tell listeners about the column and your experiences following that publication?
It's funny. I love that this has sort of become like my signature story, because at the time I was scared to death. So, I had sort of talked my way into a column at Inc., Inc. magazine. I was really floundering in my career. I had left a cushy job. I went out on my own as what I thought at the time was a freelance copywriting business turned into a marketing agency. And I got this column, and I had seen all this advice that Gary Vaynerchuk, the marketing guru, was giving about how you need to hustle all the time, so that the secret of being successful is working like a dog, just doing the actual tweeting and doing the actual whatever the social media was. And I said this in the article, I think Gary Vaynerchuk is a marketing wizard. I mean, no one becomes as successful as he is, without being a marketing wizard. At the same time, I honestly thought there was something wrong with this advice, because I of course, everyone needs to work hard, but I couldn't understand why this guy was just constantly telling entrepreneurs to work hard. We all know we have to work hard. But like, I would see all these people spending all their time tweeting and not working on their products. And I was a much bigger fan of doing systematic, I'm big on, I'll create a bunch of templates before writing the article so I can do things efficiently. So anyway, I wrote this article called Why Gary Vaynerchuk is Flat Out Wrong, talking about how the advice is, the person benefiting the most from the advice is Gary Vaynerchuk himself. I was really, this was not, a, you know, I knew about the value of picking fights just inherently, but I was still scared to death. I mean, Gary Vaynerchuk has a lot of power in our industry. I was a nobody. I remember my hand actually, I don't know if this is just poetic or if this actually happened, but I have this memory of my hand like hovering over the mouse, you know?
I'm sure it's real. I mean, it's very frightening. You don't want to poke the bear, and that's what you're doing. And in fact, that's what you're advising, is sometimes strategically poking the bear is a good idea.
Yeah.
But how is this different from trolling people? Because it is different. And you really need to understand the difference.
Thank you for that. I love that you brought that up. I mean, because I think a lot of people think I'm telling them to troll people. I think that's the unsophisticated way of doing it. Trolling people, which I think is not a good idea, is going out into the world and insulting people based on something you may or may not really believe just to get publicity. And there is such thing as bad publicity, right? I mean, there's that famous case of... I guess her name was Justine Sacco, this woman who told a really off-color joke on Twitter in its early years, and it destroyed her career, right? Because she was just trying to be controversial. If you, for example, to use myself, you know, as a guinea pig here as an example, when I wrote about Gary Vaynerchuk, I was beyond respectful. I attacked the content of his ideas. I never attacked him. I never attacked his personality. I never attacked his looks, not that there's anything to attack, but I didn't attack the way he dressed. I didn't attack the way he speaks too loudly.
You talked about his message and the impact of his message on people.
Right. That's what I did. And I think that's the thing. I think it's about taking a stand. I think it's about being bold. I think it's about drawing a line in the sand. I don't think it's about hurting people or insulting people.
Right. Well, I agree. I think that is very smart and very clever. One of the things you also mention in your book is the importance of using influencers to help your cause, which I think a lot of people understand. But how do you get the attention of an influencer? How do you find the mini Oprah in your niche? Because you can't Google, you know, mini Oprah insurance. How do you find those influential people? What is it that you look for in order to identify who those people are?
My answer, so there's two things here. One is, how do you find the people in your niche, right? Because we're not trying to get influencers. We're trying to get the most influential people in our segment of the world, right? Yeah.
Right.
So, which is, you know, so, and the idea is that for every person who, for every story where we think that people have built themselves up in a grassroots way, there's someone pulling the strings in the background. But you can find those people and get them to take you under their wing. So how do you find out who they are? I used to have a very systematic approach. I used to say, you know, make a grid and take all of the podcasters, bloggers, article writers, whatever, in your field and put them on the y-axis, you know, the up and down axis, put the same ones on the x-axis, and the ones who are mentioned the most, those are your influencers. And you could do that, you know, but I think...
Well, that goes to your systematic approach. I think that that's actually, you know, do your homework and it'll help you out.
Yeah. I also think, though, there's something to be said for the art of it. I mean, the more you are in a field, like my mother doesn't know who Gary Vaynerchuk is, you know, but you and I, who are in not the same field, but in fields that touch, you know what I mean? Both know who he is, and he's kind of a celebrity. So sometimes you just kind of know.
Right.
In terms of how to reach them, it's funny. I think it's, I don't want to say easier, but more simple to connect with people and bond with them than people think. I mean, everyone always says it's who you know. But like, for example, what I'll often see people, hey, I really want to reach X and Y person. So they'll write them an email or a LinkedIn message and they'll say something like, you know, I noticed that you and I have many of the same connections. I would like to pick your brain, you know.
Oh my God, the brain picking. No.
You know, yeah. You know, so I think the key is to sort of just like realize that these are human beings with interests and things like that. So like, I remember, anyone who reads my book will realize this. I put a lot of musical references because I'm into that. And I like punk music a lot. And there's this guy, Brian Clark, who is a real bigwig. You know, he started Copy Blogger in our world. But I just noticed from a lot of his references, he once in a great while, once every 40 tweets or whatever, he would talk about some hardcore band. And then he had like Henry Rollins from Black Flag speak at one of his events. So I'm like, it's like, I remember when I used to walk up the Ocean City Boardwalk, if I saw someone in a Black Flag shirt, I'd be like, hey man, he'd be like, hey, it's like the punk rock bond. So I started like mentioning stuff about Black Flag and we like bonded over that. So like, don't hammer people about their industry and everything that they can do for you. They'll never get back to you. But if there's some interest that you share or something human that you share, it's amazing. People act like people, you know what I mean? And they'll respond to you, you know?
Right. Well, people are people. Yeah. So let's move on to packaging. And by packaging, I'm talking about how you, as the hype artist, present yourself. It's your look, your name, and well, your personal packaging. And it's pretty important. And why is that? Why is the book cover actually, it matters?
Yeah, people don't judge a book by its cover, right?
That's sure they do.
Great lies, the last 300 years. I think it's because of the way our brains are wired. I mean, there's been a lot of research on this from a neurological perspective, and paleontologists and evolutionary psychologists have studied this. Mammal brains in particular, human brains in very, very particular, are not set up to see the world accurately. They're set up to survive and pass on their genes. And what that means is that if you see the world accurately enough, that's what's important. So like, I mean, this is almost a cliche now, but if you hear a rustle in the brush and it's nothing, but you get scared and jolt, you'll live. But if you hear a rustle in the brush and it's a tiger, you'll live. But if you don't jolt, the tiger will eat you, right? So I think packaging is the same thing. We have a lot of experience in our lives. And if we had to assess every person we met and every opportunity anew and look at all the facts anew every single time, we would go crazy. So we create these mental shortcuts. What wires together, fires together. What fires together, wires together. So you start to say, okay, black and white equals, cheap, right? Or glossy pages equals high budget and professional. So you start to make these associations and you do them in a millisecond. And you got to realize that people care about that. Right? They don't even know they care about it. They may say they don't care about it, but they care so much about it.
Well, so there are obvious flamboyant examples in the book, Bowie, Warhol, but what would be a business example? Like how would a, again, I'm picking on insurance, but I want to be the go-to guy in insurance. What kind of packaging do I look for? What does that mean for me? How do I stand out?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? Because someone like David Bowie or Warhol, they're quite literally in art. So right. We expect them to be flamboyant. I think what I would first ask the question, what do you want to be known for in insurance, right? So because I don't know the answer to that in insurance, I can give a really easy example about the tech industry, right? Because now we have this thing where it used to be that to be professional, I'm going to just talk about clothing, but this goes for the book covers, everything else you do. But like for a while it was, if you were a professional, you wore a suit and tie. And then there got to be this thing where people like Zuckerberg wore a hoodie, because that's what he felt like wearing. And then whatever, Steve Jobs wore the turtleneck. So now if you go to any tech meetup, or not meetup, like a big tech convention or a media convention, there's not one tie in the place. And if someone is wearing a tie, they're square, right? So if they're not wearing hoodies, they're usually wearing a blazer, jeans, and really expensive sneakers, right?
Right.
So imagine if you dug into yourself. Now, so that's the new suit and tie. You're not setting yourself apart. So imagine if you said, okay.
Right, I was just thinking that. So then maybe you go in the bow tie and the, and the thing, yeah.
If that's who you are. So I think that's the thing. It's always got to start with what are you trying to convey and what's the comfortable extension of yourself. So in other words, let's say that your technology is all about, efficiency. Let's just make it simple. It's a customer relationship management tool that's about simplicity, that's all about simplicity, right? That it's about making people's lives easier, you know, and then your website should be insanely easy to navigate. It shouldn't have lots of copy. Maybe it should have 5 words on it and convey a whole lot. Maybe you should wear the same thing anytime anyone sees you, because you can then talk about how that eliminates choices in your life, and your whole thing is to make things simple and eliminate choices. Maybe your book cover should just be red with no words on it. So it's that kind of thing. It's like, what are you trying to say, and how do you make it consistent? And is it really lined up with who you are? I think Zuckerberg wore the hoodie because there's no way that guy was ever going to wear a suit, you know?
Right. And so it's really interesting. It's not necessarily standing out. It's being consistent with your message and really owning what that thing is. So I have another question for you. Mm-hmm. You know, as I was reading through the book, we're setting ourselves up in opposition. We're branding ourselves as visually distinct. But then there was the need to give milk before the meat, which is an expression that means we have to make our message easier to digest and more similar to what people are used to hearing before we pull out the big guns. And I guess my question is, how does that square with the previous advice? Because, you know, drawing a line in the sand with Vaynerchuk is not the milk meal, right?
That's right. No, it's both. It depends what you're trying to do and when. And this is where it gets where it gets subtle and where it gets tricky. And I think a good shortcut is if you're in a crowded field. So if you're in insurance, right? Everyone's in insurance. At that point, you need to package yourself to, for lack of a better word, stand out. You need to, you know, everyone in insurance is saying that you're protecting yourself against something awful happening, you know? And you say, you know what? Insurance isn't really the best way to protect yourself against something awful happening. What do you mean? No, insurance is actually an investment vehicle.
Right.
If you want to protect yourself against something awful happening, start saving early and set up a trust. That's not what insurance is for. So that gets someone's attention, whether or not that's true.
Right.
But if you're packaging a brand new idea, something that could be hard to digest, that's when you got to do milk before meat. So like, I mean, I use a lot of examples in religion because by their very nature, religions are, are weird in terms of they're new. I mean, they're things that people, you know, don't have an easy time digesting. But I don't know, a business example might be, let me think. We're going, what you know, let's think of an idea. Oh, okay. A computer, here's a great example. I mean, keyboards, typewriter keyboards, the word keyboard was taken from musical keyboards.
Right.
You know what I mean? They didn't come up with a brand new word. They didn't, you know, I don't know, have things scattered in on the sides of someone's head. They could have done that. They put it in front of you, laid out like a musical keyboard, because at that time, no one would have had any idea what to do with that. So they needed some sort of touchstone. You got to give the baby their milk before you give them their meat, because it was brand new.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. That's a great example. I like that one. You know, in your book, you also talk about the utility of being a trickster for good. And what I was wondering, is this something that all types of business people can employ, or is it really something that only certain segments can use? You know, if your brand is truth, won't being a trickster demand too much of a pivot later on?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, again, I think it depends. I this was a chapter, to refer to the book, since we are talking about the book, where I tried to be really clear that this is best used for people who are on the margins, who don't have opportunities, right? So like if you come into, you know, with connections, with a degree from Wharton, with some capital, you kind of have maybe too much to lose being a trickster, right?
Right.
But if you don't have you know, opportunities and you need to sort of muscle your way in there, being a trickster, I think works well, and then you pivot away. But to answer your question, it's also a function of what a trickster means.
Right.
The way I've defined it, I don't think a trickster means a liar.
Okay.
I mean, lying is lying. You know what I mean? I mean, if you're going around just like telling untruths, that's lying. What I'm talking about is benevolent mischief. You know what I mean? I mean, I think Pussy right. Riot were tricksters. Again, it's a rock and roll example, but they, right. you know, went up on a cathedral during a Russian mass singing an anti-Putin prayer. They didn't lie. They said stuff they believed in, but it was a prank. It was a trick.
Well, right? and it was also, yeah. it was very brand consistent.
Right.
I like mischief. I like yeah. that it's like the wink. It's putting the wink, it's putting a little bit of humor. It's doing that. I like that. And I also enjoyed in the book the evolution of trickster, the evolution of trickster through the mythologies, and then, you know, you had been talking about religion in relation to the milk before meat, but how part of our mental trickster equals liar is actually a function of the more recent incarnation of what trickster meant in religious terms. So I thought that was really interesting. One of the other things that I'd like to talk about is the importance of certainty and mm-hmm. why certainty is so persuasive, and how facts and figures relate to this. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I don't know 100% the science about why we're so attracted to authority. It might have some and certainty. It might have something to do with tribalism, that like there was all, you know, an alpha who acted decisively and we all had to, you know, follow that person. You know, there have been a lot of experiments showing that we most certainly do defer to authority, and authority is sometimes conveyed as certainty. So, I mean, to use an example, I can say it's not a place to get political, but everyone's political now. I'm not a fan of our president. I think he's really incompetent at a lot of what he does. And I think the only reason he's gotten as far as he has is because he speaks with absolute certainty he'll speak with absolute certainty about two completely opposite things.
In the same paragraph. Yes.
You know, yeah.
Yes.
And he 35% of the country or whatever it is believes both of them.
Well, what's interesting, I actually was talking in a previous interview with a gentleman who studies activism and brand loyalty and consumer reaction. And after the interview, we were talking offline about the phenomenon of Trump and his behavior maybe not being consistent with the values of some of his followers. Right. And what was interesting was the researcher said, well, actually, if you tease out what he says both things. And so you can pick right. and choose what you want to hear. And you're right. It's said with great authority. I think linked into your chapters on certainty, you talked about how facts and figures and data and science related to this. And certainly, even earlier in our conversation, you're talking about the mammalian brain. And I'm like, oh yeah, the mammalian exactly. brain. Yeah. There right. you go. Right. I got right. that. Right. That right. makes sense.
Right.
And there's something that's comforting. And maybe that's my jam. You know, I'm like, ooh, you know, developmental biology, gotcha. You win me. But I think that's you're persuasive.
Alone. Yeah, yeah, I don't think you're alone. Yeah. It's funny, you've sussed this out a lot, that sometimes two things that seem contradictory exist in this thing that I'm calling hype. So on one hand, I think it's really important to simplify complex messages, right. but sometimes the best thing you can do is to complicate simple messages, right? So like, I could have easily just said to you, and again, all the research I'm giving you is based on actual research. I just finished writing a book about this, so I did a lot of research. That being said, I could have kind of said, people like shortcuts, you know, they don't want to listen to a bunch of gobbledygook. So they don't want to dig deep into the facts.
And then they also get a Brooklyn accent.
You know, yeah, exactly. Because the Brooklyn accent makes you.
Brooklyn accent says heuristic.
Yeah, that makes you a total idiot. You know what I mean? You have a Brooklyn accent. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so okay. Never have a Brooklyn accent when you're trying to.
When you're talking to the VCs.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think, you know, it's heuristics. I think that people like proxies. I think, for instance, we have a remarkable example of the smart people in the room following this to a fault with Quibi. I think that a lot of the smart people in the room said, you know, Meg Whitman, Katzenberg, I don't need to look at their business plan, right, that PowerPoint. I'm just going to give them money. And then they said, oh, other people are giving them money, so it must be good. Even though any 100%. Other person with that plan would have been told to, you know, go look at the competitive landscape. And guess what? Short videos already exist. It's Instagram, it's YouTube. They've been around for a while. So, you know, I think that that's everybody. Everybody does that. I think you're absolutely right. And I also think a related point to this is how repetition relates to hype, right, and why it works. And anyone from New York remembers the Andre the Giant stickers. And can you share that story and tie it back to this thesis?
Yeah, sure. So Shepard Fairey, who would originally go on to become very, very famous as the guy, the artist who created the Hope poster for Barack Obama, started out, you know, he went to Rhode Island School of Design, and he got interested in propaganda. He just started to get really fascinated by what is it that makes certain art stick in people's heads, right? So while a lot of his contemporaries were kind of slaving away on whatever they were doing, painting or industrial design or whatever, he commandeered a silkscreen machine and just printed out these, you know, thousands of stickers, first flyers and then stickers and decals that said, that just of Andre the Giant, the professional wrestler's face for no real reason whatsoever, that said Andre the Giant. Some of them said Obey, which was from a movie called They Live. And then some of them said Andre the Giant has a posse. And he just stuck this thing everywhere, him and his, you know, friends. And what's interesting is the image was really streamlined. So it wasn't like a photograph of Andre the Giant as such. It was a photograph that was like made kind of black and white and only the outline, you know, of his features. And then this very bold type. And it was, it means nothing. It literally means nothing. And it just became a phenomenon. I mean, people started to want Obey on clothing. They started to reproduce it on their own. To this day, there are facsimiles of this Andre the Giant thing everywhere. And it's just, there's just, I think it has something to do with the way we learn language. You know, Steven Pinker wrote a book called The Language Instinct, where he talks about the way our brains are set up as babies to do this very complicated thing, which is learn an entire set of codes, you know what I mean? To understand other people and communicate. We use these simplifying devices, and rhyming is one of them. Repetition is the biggest one. We run statistics in our brains. Like the baby's mind is fascinating. But as a result, we're really, just like we're attacked, you know, just like the reason we like sugar and fat is because sugar gives us energy, fat gives us stores. We like repetition because that was something that we fed off of as children. And so just by repeating a message over and over and over and over again, even if people reject it or say they're bored of it, they'll come to love it. You know, I mean, I remember I used to hate that song, Shake It Up, that Taylor Swift song. Like I didn't remember. And now I think it's the world's catchiest song. We've all had that experience, right? And it's
don't
the same with everything.
Don't even say any earworms. Oh my God.
Yeah,
you gotta, no,
exactly.
No.
Yeah.
Earworm is a good tie-in to their last question is around discomfort. And we've talked about opposition, showmanship, packaging, milk before meat. And I want to close on why making people a little uncomfortable works. And can you explain that?
Okay, so in my research, this was something that I didn't come to intuitively. Like I intuitively understood the fight picking and the probably even the repetition, although I got some nuance around it. This concept totally came out of my research, and I interviewed some people to confirm it. And it's really fascinating. So it's really counterintuitive. So the idea is that we all think that winning people over, driving attention, building a following is about making people happy. And for the most part, it is. It's about giving them more pleasure, giving them more comfort or happiness or pleasure, joy, whatever those positive words are. It turns out that the best hype artists, the people who really, really do a good job of this emotion creation, tend to inject a tiny bit of discomfort into the happiness. Andy Warhol, he basically ran these giant parties called the Exploding Plastic Inevitable in the 60s. And anytime you go to a big rave or dance club, it's a direct descendant from this. And whenever he would see people just sort of partying or doing the twist or having fun, he would put like some discordant noise or some crazy light. That's where strobe lights come from, because they're not inherently pleasurable. And it hooked people in. And the other example is Tony Robbins, that thing he does where he gets you to walk on hot coals. You know, where the story there is that by walking on hot coals at a seminar, you're confronting your fears. And that may be true. I have no clue. But what's really funny is that there are religious groups, especially this group in Greece, that has been doing a very similar thing for hundreds of years. And they've tried to make it illegal, and people will just not stop doing the thing. And when you ask them why they walk on hot coals and scald their feet, they say, I don't know, I get a spiritual experience. But the fact of the matter is, there's a scientific paper written that a small amount of discomfort and pain can create transcendence. It can literally create a feeling of ecstasy or a feeling of being bigger than yourself or part of a group. And it's just a weird thing, but it's true. And we see it time and time again. You know, it doesn't have to be physical pain though. It can be putting a little bit of a rub in your message. It can be making people feel
a little
sort
insecure,
of,
little bit of like, ooh, well, in some ways it's, I've got to listen to the next episode because there's something I don't know. And if I don't know it, I might mm-hmm. not be as strong as I would right. otherwise be.
That's right.
So this book is being released January.
So yeah, it's coming out January 12th. McGraw-Hill is putting it out. I'm very excited about that.
I got an advanced copy. Everybody yeah. should read it. It's very good, fun stories
you.
And a quick read. So it's really great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Gabriella. This was such a blast.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.